bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. We're glad that you decided to join us. Thank you. Did you know there is a subversive effort to destroy the Electoral College through state compacts? Our in-house legal eagle, Joe Wolverton, joins us to talk about that. Hey, Joe.
Hello, Paul. Happy to be with you again.
Oh, I'm happy to have you. I just thought of that song, the Jimi Hendrix song, when I said that. I don't know why I pointed that out, but
everybody always mentions it.
Right? We have you here, and we have Gary Benoit, who's the editor-in-chief of The New American, and he's going to join us in this conversation, and it's going to be a good one. I think a lot of people may not be aware of this. I'm going to admit my ignorance or lack of being informative here, that this is something I realized was a serious threat not too long ago. I think you had brought it up maybe in a meeting, or it was in an issues meeting we were talking. And so I was like, man, you know, we probably need to share that with folks. So I'm a hand it off to you here. What is going on? What are these state compacts, and how serious of a threat is this?
Well, the state compacts are attempts to pass something called, typically called, the national popular vote. And what it is, it's states who are trying to pass resolutions to join together to abolish the Electoral College and have the president elected simply on popular vote. Right. Just count the votes. Whichever candidate has the most votes, taking the country as a whole, that guy wins.
Yeah.
And now that's what it is. What's the attempt? What's the comeback? Now, the threat is we would end up having a president elected by the East Coast and West Coast elites. Mixed in with some of the Chicagoites. And so you see how Chicago's governed, you see how California's governed, you see how New York's governed. And if we, you know, abolish the Electoral College, then we'll be nothing but a California writ large.
Well, this, you've written at length about this national popular vote. And so where are we? I mean, how do the states, there's certain states that are coming together, have they passed anything, or how exactly does this work?
Well, they're mostly non-binding resolutions. Mostly it's states who want, they're basically, it's one of these things where they're trying to make a statement where the statement has no legal punch, but they're hoping that it has a popular punch, in the sense that if people see that these states are passing resolution saying we prefer that our president be elected by we the people, that message will resonate with people who don't understand the genius of Republican, with small r, Republican government. Mm-hmm. That just like how they did with the 17th Amendment, right? I mean, much of the federal tyranny that we suffer is a result of the 17th Amendment taking the Senate out of the hands of the state legislators and placing it in the hands of the people. And this is the idea with the president now. They're making the appeal saying, well, shouldn't we have a president that is elected by we the people? And that was argued by the very wise men who drafted our Constitution, and their study of history revealed that a popular election of a president would be disastrous.
Well, speaking of the 17th Amendment, that's one of the things I wanted to discuss, because that was brought in. Early 20th century, right? It was changed. Right. What exactly did the 17th Amendment do, and why is that so important to? I guess it was another step in destroying a Republican form of government.
Right. The 17th Amendment altered the Constitution and changed the Constitution, where rather than the United States senators being elected by the states, and the United States senators are now elected by the people of the states. And so what that did, the effect of that, was to remove all power that the states used to have over Congress. Because in the days prior to the 17th Amendment, if the House of Representatives got out of hand, if the Senate got out of hand, the states simply could recall their senators or refuse to send senators, because the states would say, we're not going to even let Congress vote on something that's going to turn us into wage slaves or something that's going to subvert the sovereignty of the states. Whereas now that it's popularly elected, the states have no authority over the Senate. They're not able to recall someone that was elected by the people at large. Mm-hmm. And the appeal of that, of course, is shouldn't we elect our representatives?
Right.
Yeah, we should. That's why we elect the House of Representatives. The Senate was meant to play an entirely distinct role, which today it really is unable to play. That is to say, represent the states as sovereign republics.
Gary,
well, yes. And of course, the reason it was set up the way it was to begin with is because the confederation of states that we have created the federal government. Mm-hmm. The federal government did not create the states. And so the idea of having both a House and a Senate was that in order for legislation to become law, it would have to be supported by a majority of people is represented by their representatives in the House of Representatives. And a majority of states is represented by the senators in the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. And only if both bodies, the House and the Senate, supported that legislation, could it be passed by Congress and sent on to the president for his signature or veto.
And I've written about this for the New American. There are about the 17th Amendment. There are innumerable examples of times when the Senate, prior to the 17th Amendment, were able to put the brakes on federal tyranny.
Oh, right? Tell us about that.
Well, just anything. Anytime the federal government decided to flex and, you know, try to exercise unconstitutional authority, the states would simply withdraw senators and say, come home until we're not voting on this. And so you'd have a situation where legislation wouldn't make it to the desk of the president because senators would be recalled by the state legislature.
Can you imagine a time during this legislative session, federal legislative session, where the 17th Amendment, not having had the 17th Amendment, having that old that other system, would have come in handy in reining some of the tyranny and the garbage legislation that's going through Congress?
Oh, absolutely. Any of this, Bureau of Land Management that you and Dennis were talking about, any of the Department of Education stuff, any of the red flag laws.
What about FISA?
FISA, absolutely. FISA, the militarization of the local police. None of this would be possible but for the 17th Amendment.
All right. So back to this national popular vote. My understanding is that the idea here is once they get enough states in this compact to equal the 270 electoral votes, then that would essentially abolish the Electoral College without doing so, officially. What is that close? I mean, where is that and how much of a threat is this?
Well, it's not being very successful insofar as that particular effort is concerned. But Paul and Gary, the problem is, and y'all know it as well as anyone, and anyone who is an observer of the system knows this, that the Electoral College is not functioning as it was designed. The clever trick, the sort of sleight of hand used by the statists is to continue propping up this Electoral College, but behind the scenes, it's functioning as almost a de facto popular vote as it is. That is to say, we're not having the states elect, you know, the people of the states elect this group of people that they trust to weigh the various candidates and their positions and the characteristics, the qualifications of these people running for president. Essentially, they take the popular vote, they divide it up whatever way the state says, and those become their electoral votes. And now, yes, it still does function in the sense that we don't have a popularly elected president and the electoral votes still do count. Mm-hmm. But if we went back to the idea of the founders as explained by Hamilton in Federalist 68, for example, if y'all have 5 minutes, read that document today, Federalist 68, where he explains the genius of this system, where we're getting farther away from the genius of that system Now, and like I say, it's not because of the national popular vote. It's mostly because of the agenda of statists who are pushing for the popular election of the president, but they want to do it behind the, you know, the thin veil of the Electoral College.
And they apparently want to do it despite the fact that the Electoral College is in the Constitution itself.
Right.
And
exactly.
I think that confuses a lot of people. How can you do this when the Electoral College is in the Constitution? That is to say, how can you have a national popular vote when that goes against the Constitution? And my understanding, Joe, and you can tell me if I'm incorrect, but my understanding is that the states who agree to become part of this compact, the states that agree to have a national popular vote, that when they send their electors, I don't know if the electors physically go to Washington, maybe they stay in the states, but when the electors vote for president, they're going to vote for whoever won the national popular vote, which may not be the person who won that state. And if that is the case, doesn't that disenfranchise the people who voted for the president or voted for the candidate who did not get the national popular vote?
It absolutely disenfranchises those people, as well as disenfranchising any voter who doesn't live in an urban area.
Yeah,
because you're going to have, you know, Georgia's votes will go to Atlanta, right? Texas will have Dallas and Houston. Illinois will be Chicago. If you live in rural Illinois, you might as well not vote because your vote's not going to be counted. And you're exactly right. It does disenfranchise thousands of people, and it turns the election of the president. It makes the president basically the de facto delegate of the moneyed elite globalists that are already so deeply entrenched in our government as the deep state, as we call it.
Well, we already have a problem with that in the sense that we have a lot of, well, you mentioned Illinois. Illinois, everyone knows, is run by Chicago. I lived out in the Intermountain West, and which we're very familiar with, where lots of people are coming from California, from Washington and Oregon. And as you likely know, in Oregon and in Washington, they have a huge problem with being pulled by the nose by the elites in Eugene, in Seattle, Portland, whereas the rest of the states, which are mostly is rural and they're the producers, they want to get out of there because they're not being represented. Now, apparently there's also a movement, and this is a little sidebar here, but there's a movement in some states, and let me know if some of it has taken root, where they're trying to get some sort of electoral structure within the states themselves. Like, I think Kansas might be one of them. Does this ring a bell?
Right, that Kansas was, well, if you're talking about the sense that Kansas wanted to, there were a couple of bills in Kansas and Arizona where they wanted to make sure that no one voted who wasn't a citizen. Is that what you're talking about?
No. I'm talking about where they're trying to get more representation throughout the states, even in the less populated areas of the states. And so go on.
Well, no, sorry about that. Yeah, well, the only thing I know about this is that, well, first of all, yeah, they're trying to move the population through, you know, various globalist schemes that have been implemented throughout different states. I know Utah is eaten alive with some of this stuff with moving, you know, planning these communities and making it where, you know, they're planned communities. And so you can predict all the behavior, all the electoral behavior and all of that. But I'll tell you, Paul, if you want to talk about, you know, sort of things that are happening that people maybe don't put two and two together, is all of the illegal immigration. You understand, electors are constitutionally added up by the number of representatives and the number of senators for each state. Well, the census doesn't distinguish between citizen and non-citizen.
Well, Trump tried to get that through, but that didn't work, did it?
Hey, America. How tired are you of mainstream corporate media's biased narratives and manipulated news? Their dishonesty and attempts to influence this generation have been exposed, put on display for anyone who's even half paying attention. But the New American Magazine has been an honest source of news and commentary for over 50 years. This is your opportunity to receive the stalwart of principled journalism at a deep discount. picture a beautifully published magazine arriving at your doorstep twice a month, packed with insightful stories written with integrity. It's also available digitally on the New American's mobile app. Get up to speed with intelligent coverage from a freedom perspective. Right now, for a limited time, The New American is available to radio listeners at a 25% discount on a new subscription. Visit thenewamerican.com/radio25 and receive 25% off. Subscribe today at thenewamerican.com/radio25.
We must remember that the opposition has some very clever people working for them who want to do this, in sort of a very surreptitious manner. By getting these illegal immigrants into certain what otherwise would be called red states, getting them in there, getting the census where they'll, you know, assign greater number of representatives. That way they'll have more electors, and these states, you won't have illegal immigrants voting as such. And these people will come out and say, no, we don't agree with that. We think you should be a citizen to vote. But what they're doing surreptitiously is they're moving and encouraging the movement of these illegal immigrants into red states. And the idea being that, no, you're not going to vote. But what's going to end up happening is you're going to have the electors that are going to represent the population as such. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have illegal immigrants influencing the election of the president without having the taint of voting and not being a citizen, if that makes any sense. And so you have these people that are purposely shepherding them toward places where they can have influence, and you could have a whole state flip very quickly because of the way, not through illegal immigrant voting. I mean, that does obviously happen, but through the census system and through a sense of, well, you know, we've got 300,000 new residents from whatever country, shouldn't they be represented, et cetera, et cetera. And so that ends up flipping these states, and the Electoral College becomes a means mm-hmm. of manipulating elections.
Right.
Because it doesn't function like it should. But I mean, how many people do you really think sit down and study Article 2 and say, how should the president be elected? Why do we call it the Electoral College? These are the sorts of things that if we are really friends and supporters of constitutional government, we should sit down and read Article 2 closely to understand Article 2, to understand what the Electoral College was meant to do, how it's meant to function. Read Federalist 68. Get this stuff in there so that when you go to explain it to people, you explain it with some sort of not only conviction, but you explain it persuasively because you have the authority of the understanding of how it's supposed to work. We right. got to get that education. I mean, that's the reason the John Birch Society is premier.
Yeah.
Because we focus on that.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that the national popular vote isn't as much of a threat, but we've been also hinting, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm seeing this as propaganda, the attack on the Electoral College is pretty strong. And it looks mm-hmm. like what they're trying to do is they're trying to build support, right? To support right. against the Electoral College. I mean, one of the things you cite you wrote an article, I think in 2019, Colorado joined states committed to circumventing Electoral College. And mm-hmm. we've already kind of established that that isn't a huge threat. But in there, you cite an article that I kind of dug up, and that is that indicates who is working behind this effort. And so, no surprise, guess who comes up, who Joe cited? And that's Jonathan Soros, obviously son of George Soros. In this case, the apple didn't fall too far from the tree, as I understand, as with Alex and the others. But so Jonathan Soros wrote this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal called "It's Time to Junk the Electoral College." And so he explains in there how it works. You kind of already explained how it works. We have it here on the screen. But here's his gripe. And this you would say, well, that's great. We don't have a gripe with that. His gripe is that the Electoral College is anti-democratic. And so I think maybe there's some people who are listening. I know we have really smart listeners and viewers, so some of them may not be asking this, and maybe it's just me. But some would say, and this is where the propaganda, I think, really takes hold. And that is this rhetoric that democracy is the good thing. That's what we want. That's what's desirable, because the way they shape it is, that is self-governance. So I think we need to explore this faulty thinking as far as the difference between republics and democracies, as the John Birch Society has been trying to teach people, and why republicanism, small r, like you, is better than democracy, but also the fact that republicanism has elements of democracy. And so how do the two jive? How do we get people to understand? I mean, you have, for instance, big heavy hitters, media heavy hitters who I think are on our side, and people are listening and they'll say, yes, he's on our side. And I'm mentioning especially Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson always talks about, he refers to us as a democracy. I've met people in Texas, and even members of the John Birch Society who seem to be a bit confused, and they're saying we are a representative democracy, not a republic. Joe, set the record straight.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to stand on the shoulders of men greater than I, and that James Madison in Federalist 10 says, a republic is a system of government where the people rule through elected representatives. The idea being that we seek out the best and brightest and wisest and most virtuous among us, and we elect those people to represent us and to make our laws. A democracy is where the people vote directly. And in that article, in that essay, James Madison says they've been as violent in their birth as they have been in their deaths.
We have that quote by James Madison. Yeah, we'll
put that up there. They always lead to
here it is.
Democracy. There you go.
Have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the origins of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths.
And republic, we get rid of that violence through the filter of seeking out the best and brightest. And as for democracy, each individual voting on every law and every policy, I'll stand on the shoulders of Lycurgus, who, when asked why he didn't make Sparta a democracy, said, if you like democracy so much, go practice it in your family. You don't want to do that, because it's ridiculous. You end up with, anytime you have a majority that wants to rob the minority of their life, liberty, and, as Madison said, their property, then your property is theirs.
Yeah. Yeah.
In democracy, in a republic, we have preventions. We have guardrails that prevent that from happening.
Right. And of course, Madison talked about those guardrails as well. And of course, you quoted accurately what Madison said in The Federalist Number 10, but Madison, did talk about the importance of those guardrails, what today we call checks and balances.
Right. So we got Soros behind this, and we have the entire mainstream media behind it. And it seems to me like the plan is, as soon as they get enough people to buy into this, they will have already gotten the mob. Is it easier to manipulate the mob? Is that part of the thinking here? If you want to take control, or you want to destroy a nation, as obviously is the goal against the United States, why is it easier to have a democracy? Why is it easier to do that with a democracy versus a republic?
If you want to control the mob, because in a democracy, 50% plus one guy equals the law. And of course, look around. What do you think? You can put forward any sort of ideas where that would take from one man his property and give it to another, as long as you get 50% plus one guy who thinks that's a good idea, because you have too much, you are too rich, you are too privileged, and all of that shifts the other way in a democracy. Whereas in a republic, they don't have the opportunity to do that, right? You don't have the opportunity to just vote yourself into taking the property of another person, because it has to go through, as Gary rightly identified, checks and balances, right?
Right.
We have to go through these various layers that were put there to protect life, liberty, and property from the malicious intrigues of the mob. Very, very simple.
And we also have a federal government of enumerated powers.
And we have a federated, a confederated government of, sovereign, as Madison explained in 39. Each state mm-hmm. is a sovereign, independent entity.
Right. And so the government may not do whatever it chooses. And elected representatives, when they're sent to Washington, may not do whatever they choose in terms of whatever laws they make, because they take an oath to the Constitution. And so they're only allowed to do what is constitutional. And what is constitutional is based on enumerated powers, and those powers for the national government are few and defined.
Well, even if its constituents wanted to do this, they have to adhere to the law, right? That's the difference between republicanism and democracy. Am I getting that right?
Right, that's exactly right.
Well, one is the government of law, and the other is the government of man, where man rules supreme.
But laws still come from the consent mm-hmm. of the governed. So there seems to be some sort of balance there. And I think this is what's confusing. Am I revealing my pseudo-ignorance here a little bit? This does seem because it's like the balance, there seems to be a balance there. I mean, like you said, it's ruled by law. But at the same time, where does the law come from? Well, it comes from the consent of the governed.
Well, ultimately, Paul, you have a couple of things that are at the base of all of this and could cut through all of this, even beyond the 17th Amendment, beyond the Electoral College. We have Thomas Jefferson telling us that if you want to be ignorant and free,
you cannot.
You want what never was and what never will be, mm-hmm. right? And the second you have, there is no liberty without virtue. So in our country, you cannot support, it is impossible to maintain Republican form of government with all its genius, all its protections, all the wonderful protection of law afforded, the protection of life, liberty, and property afforded by a government of law, a republic like we have. You lose all of that if you have an uneducated and unvirtuous society. The greatest constant, every man who's ever written on the subject has warned that the best laws mean nothing if you have the worst people.
Wow.
We have got to work on our personal virtue and our we've got to think about this, Paul and Gary. Everybody that's watching this, we always in the John Birch Society, we want an action. We want people to do something. Go today, when you finish watching this, read Article 2, The Manner of Electing the President. Read Federalist 68 and then ponder it. Let it roll around in the old noggin for a while. Marinate in it.
Yeah.
And then go explain it to someone else. And then both y'all go down and join the John Birch Society.
I love that.
Remember when the only uncertainty in news was the weather forecast? Now, our world is clouded by half-truths, misdirection, and gaslighting. The deluge of lies from leftist activists posing as journalists is unrelenting. At The New American, we hold fast to the timeless truths of our founders, a refuge of honest reporting, sanctuary in the storm. TheNewAmerican.com. Subscribe today.
Well, we also have, we offer the booklet, Republics and Democracies, by Robert Welch, who is the founder of the John Birch Society. We offer actually a free PDF. And if you go to the John Birch, JBS.org, and you go to education, drop down there. I have it right in front of me. This is a good thing about having this here. And you have e-booklets. And there's quite a few there that we offer. But this is one of the most important one. Now, given that we've described what republicanism is and what democracy is and the differences, where would you say we are as of today? Because I'm kind of picking up that we're not in full Republican mode as we were intended to be, but it seems like we still aren't in full democracy mode, which is what we're trying to prevent. What would you say? Obviously somewhere in the middle, some sort of weird hybrid.
Well, we are a weird hybrid. I mean, Madison explained that this is a novel form of government, that we're basing it on the confederations of ancient Greece and some of the republicanism of ancient Rome. But it's a new situation. And so you have democracy in many of the states. You have plebiscites in California. They have thing. In every state, most states have some sort of democratic thing where it's just you go down and vote and whatever the majority says, that's what we do. Every state has a form of that. Because the thing people need to realize, Paul, is, gosh, and this goes back to the education, we're the United States of America is a confederation of independent sovereign republics. You notice in the Constitution, every state is guaranteed a Republican form of government. The Union is not meant to be a republic as such. It's supposed to be a collection of republics. Mm. And so we're not going to be, you can't call the federal government a republic. It's not meant to be that, right? It's like when you have a union of flower shops. If you go down to the office of the union of flower shops, you're not going to be able to buy flowers. You have to go to the individual flower shop, right? And that's the way Washington is. And we could go a long way toward obviating and abolishing all these problems with this thinking of democracy if we would simply study the Constitution, study the words of the men who drafted it, both in the Federalist, Anti-Federalist, and in the records of the ratification debates in the states, study what they meant. And then if we would, you know, if we repealed the 17th Amendment, if we restored the 10th Amendment, we'd be so much farther along toward where we want to be. But we aren't, because there's so many people who, for gosh, what, five generations now, have been indoctrinated in public schools as to the ideas of how our government is supposed to work that are completely contrary to the design set forth by our founding fathers in that document.
Right. Well, right?
So go read the document and you'll see that, and you'll see there are aspects of democracy that are fine, but we are meant to be a confederation, a union of republics.
Let me get your thought on this. I was listening to an interview sometime the other day, and they were talking about immigration, this massive immigration problem we have. Here we have the federal government having been hijacked by subversives, people who hate this country, people who now there's journalists, they've done enough research where I think we can feel confidently in saying that this is being orchestrated in large part, probably not in full, by elements within our government. Now, you know, there's J.J. Caro, who we cited. He wrote the book Invaded, and he tracks how Mayorkas, Alejandro Mayorkas, DHS secretary, he's been behind a lot of the policies that we're seeing and now really flourish for many years. He worked for Obama and whatnot. So anyway, so we have this massive, massive invasion, largest in U.S. history. It's going to doom us if we don't get it under control. And yet we don't get it under control. And so this commentator who I started out this part of the conversation, he says that states have to basically start saying no. But the way he phrased it, it was also in the sense that they're going to have to just basically ignore the Constitution and say no and start taking care of themselves. But I'm kind of picking up and thinking, well, I don't think they have to ignore the Constitution at all, right? What is your take on that? Let's take immigration and this conversation that we're having, and let's marry it.
Immigration is
the invasion. Let's call it illegal,
the invasion. Right. I was going to say, Gary probably remembers, I don't know, I think it was 2011. We had a big confab about immigration. And you know, I was on the side that it wasn't an invasion. And of course, now I realize that it is. And so kudos to Gary for recognizing, you know, 13 years ago, what I only recently recognized, that it is organized. It is an invasion. So the Constitution, as if we're talking about immigration, grants no authority. That word does not appear in the Constitution. The federal government has no authority over immigration. The federal government has granted authority over naturalization. And the way I explain that is, immigration is to naturalization what engagement is to marriage. Okay? So when you don't have to get an engagement license, right? Mm-hmm. But you get a marriage license. So immigration, that word, that authority is not granted to the federal government. These states don't have to ignore the federal government or the Constitution. They simply have to start enforcing the Constitution and acting, exercising the sovereignty that was retained by them when they formed the Union. The 10th Amendment makes that very clear, and say to the federal government, I don't care whether you treat this as an invasion, because the federal government does have power to repel invasions, but so do the states. So the states could say, if I consider this, whether you consider it immigration or invasion, I, as a sovereign part of this union, I retain the authority to protect my sovereign borders. That's an element of constitutional fidelity, not constitutional infidelity. Mm-hmm. Waiting for the feds to do something is the problem. It's very constitutional for the states to say, I'm going to control this, because whether you consider it immigration, which is not a federally delegated authority, or you consider it invasion, the states have retained the power to control both of those things. And they don't have to violate the Constitution. They simply have to exercise the authority they have retained when forming the Union. Well, it could be solved like that, Paul.
Gary, you
and of course, state officials also take an oath to the Constitution, not just federal officials.
That's right.
So not only would it be constitutional for state officials to uphold the Constitution, they are actually obligated to do so because of that solemn oath.
Yeah.
Going against the Constitution when they allow unconstitutional abuses to occur within the boundaries of their state. And of course, that's the whole principle of nullification.
Joe, right. And that's the thing. My phrase that people, you know, laugh when I say, but make America states again.
I love it.
That's the answer
that
to the problem.
That sounds like the name of a John Birch Society campaign.
I'm sure we can come to a deal and negotiate a fair price for the trademark. But what I'm saying is, Gary is exactly right. And the genius of the system, and the founders explain it even in the Federalist Papers, the genius of this system is that I really can't go and just knock on my federal senator's door and have him. I can't go down to his work. My state senator, that dude lives down the road. Mm-hmm. I see him at Tractor Supply where he works 40 hours a week. I can have influence.
Yeah,
I can influence my state government. Federal government is so controlled through the money deep state that it's nearly impossible to have influence. But you can influence your state government still.
Right.
Make you have access point. To them. Go yeah. talk to that guy. Influence that guy. Educate yourself and then go educate them and let them know that you're watching. Remind them of their Article 6 sacred oath, as Gary said.
I love that point, because that's something I often think about is, man, if we actually would adhere and recognize the power that the states are supposed to have, how awesome would that be? Because if you don't like the regulations or the laws that are passed where you live, you could just move to another county. But now instead, you got to move to like an entire other state. Other people are like leaving the country. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to what you were saying, in the sense that, you know, the states don't need permission to enforce mm-hmm. immigration to defend their borders. Okay. I mean, you both agree with that. We all agree in this room. But let's look at the reality here, because if that were the case, or if that was recognizable, then the Supreme Court of the United States, whenever someone appeals all these cases of immigration, obviously Texas, there's been quite a few of them, the Supreme Court, Joe, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't the Supreme Court say, we have no jurisdiction over this, enforce your laws, we don't care what you do? But that's not what they do. What is the disconnect?
Well, the disconnect again is the lack of education
on the Supreme Court justices' part.
On the part of the people
to view the Supreme Court as being the law of the land.
But why don't the justices say we want nothing to do with this?
Nullify this. Why wouldn't the Supreme Court do that?
Yeah. Why? No. Why don't the justices say we have nothing to do with this? This is a state's matter. But instead, they do. They chime in there. They told Texas, hey, you got to let the federal government take down the razor wire. So they obviously believe they have some jurisdiction.
Well, they got to protect their little empire, don't they, Paul? I mean, they're lawyers. They're politicians. They know that their power depends on portraying authority that they don't have.
And all of them?
Not all of them. I'm not assuming all of them. And we could have a time where enough of them say, hey, that's not our business. You guys handle it. We could have that.
Yeah. But again, if that sounds surreal, Joe, and I agree with you, but if it sounds surreal, I would point to what happened very recently with Roe versus Wade, where the Supreme Court got rid of that. A lot of people were shocked. A lot of people thought that would never, ever happen.
Right. Okay.
And why did it happen? It had a lot to do with the persistence and the perseverance of the pro-life movement. So we can change the course of history. We can change the loss of our freedom, and we can get our freedoms back again and even restore them to brighter luster than previously simply by informing people and getting them involved in the freedom movement.
Well, I will tell you, honestly, people watching, listening, the best thing— we've given you so many action, but I'm telling you one thing. The day after you attend, and this is honest, this happened to me when I was 18. The day after you attend a John Birch Society chapter meeting, you're a more educated and engaged citizen than you were the day before you attended the meeting.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt.
That is so important. Because what you end up doing is you end up meeting people like Gary Benoit and Paul Drago. You end up meeting people like this that have thought this through for years, and things that you feel in your heart, that doesn't sound right. And then you find out you're right. It isn't right. And here's how I can show you that it isn't right. And you become engaged. You become informed. And that's all we need.
Yeah.
That's all we need. We need these like-minded people. And we have the structure. And can you imagine an educated and engaged electorate? We wouldn't be having these conversations.
Well, it sounds to me like someone needs, based on what you guys are saying, and I'm sorry to keep harping at this, but we need a Supreme Court that understands this. Now, you brought up Roe v. Wade, and so maybe I'm going to help you guys out here a little bit, because up until 2022 and up until this version of SCOTUS, all the other versions said that we're going to follow precedent. This is the law of the land and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, this group of justices said, no, this was not. I don't know if it was Alito or Thomas who said that this isn't in the Constitution or isn't a right like they claim. Right. So maybe it sounds to me like maybe we can at some point get a Supreme Court that realizes that we don't have any say in what the feds do. I mean, immigration. This is a state's issue. It should not come to the U.S. Supreme Court. Because I'm a bit confused, because I guess it is a little bit hard to believe that out of all nine of those, and some of them, I think we all agree that some are better than others. And I don't know, Joe, which one is your favorite, but you would think that there's at least one or two there who would understand this. Apparently not. Because this is a serious issue, and this could be one of the straw that breaks the camel's back as far as the United States being. I mean, this can crumble. You bring all these people in, there's various elements that they're going to pile onto each other, and then the back's going to break.
This weekend, the New American's Veronica Kirilenko heads to Bucharest, Romania for the Make Europe Great Again conference. Coverage starts soon. Stay tuned.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's what did Madison call it in Federalist 46? To think that all this can happen, and just because we're the United States of America, we won't crumble like the other empires before us. That's what do they call it? He called it a fever dream.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's crazy talk. We will go the route of Rome, right? If we continue along this path. But as far as the Supreme Court, Paul, we can nullify that branch of the federal government as easily as we nullify the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Our great hope is to restore this country to what it was meant to be, a union of sovereign republics. And if we do that, then we nullify not only unconstitutional acts of Congress, unconstitutional acts of the president, but unconstitutional acts of the Supreme Court as well.
Yeah.
We make these 50 states. Imagine and imagine the federal influence you would have on a state when if you have a state where all these people who love freedom are immigrating to that state. You suddenly have that population growing, a population becoming more prosperous, and it also becomes constitutionally more influential.
Yeah. You do have that happen to a degree, don't you? Because you have a lot of people fleeing California, for example.
Well, they lost. Right. Was it one or two representatives they lost?
That's right.
And that's despite all the illegals that they've been flooded with over the last couple of decades.
But I mean, imagine just going to your, you know, Article 6, where the founding fathers listed the supreme law of the land. Supreme Court opinions is not on that list. They left it off that list on purpose because it was the Supreme Court has no authority as anything like that authority.
Well, the Supreme Court is there to interpret, right? Interpret where's
among
the line?
The sister branches. Interpret among, they are there to say, President, this is beyond your constitutional authority. Congress, this is beyond your constitutional authority. They're not meant to be redefining laws made by Congress and then forcing those laws on the people. I mean, having nine people rule over 300 million is not a republic. That's an oligarchy.
Mm-hmm. Black robe oligarchy.
We can't have these five justices overruling the will of 300 million Americans.
Yeah.
We can't do that. And so the way we do that is we insist, like Gary. See, this is the thing. You go to John Birch Society meeting, you meet Gary Benoit. I'm not flattering you. I'm being serious because then you can see Article 6 requires state lawmakers to swear an oath to support the Constitution. Well, if you're voting in any way or if you're refusing to act in any way that supports the Constitution, you're violating an oath that you swore.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can, but you've got to let your state senator and state rep know that you know. Right. You've got to let them know. Go to make an appointment. Show up at committee meetings. Show up at votes. Make an appointment with him in his office. Go visit him. Say, hey, I know that you have an oath. Do you know how many state senators I've talked to that have no idea about their Article 6 oath? I have spoken to so many state legislators who have no idea that's in there. I show that to them and they are literally shocked.
I want to go back to nullification. We were talking about that earlier this week. I think you were in that seat there, Gary. And at the time, it reminded me of a Rage Against the Machine song. And it starts out with some bad words, but then it says, "I won't do what you tell me." I feel like that's something that states need to understand and to start telling the federal government, because that seems to be the place where we're at. We should have been there a long time ago, but the federal government has brainwashed people. Had, like you said, generations of people have grown up thinking that whatever the feds say, it's basically written in gold. You might as well call it the Bible. But people need to realize that as states, we have these powers, and especially states who are led by sane, rational people who do actually like America, you know, who don't want this invasion, who don't want the federal government telling them to shut us down, to, you know, barricade us in our homes, shove an injection in our bodies. And if we want to have any participation in society, we need to get to a point, and I want you guys to chime in, is where people realize it's time to start telling the federal government, we're not going to do what you tell us. Now, isn't there power in that? If a bunch of states come together and they say, we're not going to do it, because obviously there is some danger. I would think that would inspire maybe, or that provide the perfect reason for the federal government to start aching for the destruction, the unrest that they want. But if the states come together and they all start saying, we're not going to do what you tell us, then isn't there more power if more of them come together and do that?
The more that come together, the more power there will be.
Yes. And
what we're talking about specifically is unconstitutional law.
Well, obviously.
And
right.
This is, well, in point
Sorry,
of fact,
I'm glad you
to be,
pointed,
to be very pedantic about it, there's no such thing as unconstitutional law, because if it's unconstitutional, it's not law.
That's a really good point.
It's redundant, Gary.
And there's also God's law, and let's keep that in mind as well. And maybe a good example to point to would be Nazi Germany, because if you look at the murderers, you know, the people who actually carried out the heinous crimes in Nazi Germany, those who survived the war, didn't they claim, well, I was ordered to do it. I had no choice because I was ordered.
Yeah.
That didn't work very well, did it? They were still executed.
I mean, imagine if we held the federal authorities right now to the Nuremberg trial standard with regard to the Constitution. Every one of them would hang. Because the excuse, well, I was just doing what I was told, or someone said this is what we're supposed to do, that didn't work in the Nuremberg trials, exactly as Gary said, right? But the thing, again, we come to this point. How do we say no to the federal government? We say no to the federal government by electing state legislators and governors who say no to the federal government. Mm-hmm. Because the states are the creator. The federal government is the creation. We as states have that authority. So you don't have to worry about, there's no way we're going to elect enough representatives or federal senators or Supreme Court justices or president. Don't worry about that right now. Worry about making America states again. Go down, elect state legislators, show them Article 6, tell them that you know Article 6, and now you know that they know. And tell them you're watching and tell them you expect them to be true to that oath by forcing the federal beast back inside its constitutional cage and by refusing to enact or participate in any act of the federal government that exceeds its constitutional authority. And the way, so Paul, the answer to the question is simple. Yes, we unite together as states. But what we do to begin with is we unite together as patriots within our states and get representatives, state, quit looking at the feds as like the ultimate. Look to your state legislature, your state governor, and elect people there that understand the Constitution and will refuse to cooperate with the unconstitutional acts. As read Federalist 46, and he puts the plan there. Federalist 46, Madison said, if it all happens, here's the plan. It's not going to happen here in America, but if it does, here's a plan for undoing it. Right. We simply have to implement that plan.
Yeah.
Right. That's all we have to do. And we can literally fix this. As Gary says, it only takes a generation.
Right? Well, that sounds like that question needs to be part of the litmus test for elected representatives is, are you willing to say no to the feds? And do you realize that in certain instances, you have an obligation to do it? Because it seems like a lot of them do not understand that. I mean, as I covered, even out in Montana, when I would cover politics, there seemed to be, I would say, a majority of them, the representative state lawmakers, they didn't necessarily understand that. They didn't understand that we should say no to the feds. And it was this culture, and this isn't just that. It's probably even more prevalent in other states. But the idea is to just give the people what they want. You could read the press releases, and you could see their agendas. It was this pandering. The pandering is what matters, is what seems to be top priority to the people who are elected. How can I get elected? What do I need to say to get elected? And then what do I need to do to keep being elected? Because most of them are working their way up to federal office and whatnot. So we need, we clearly, obviously, you know, I guess I'm just reiterating what you're saying there is we need to watch these folks and we need to elect the right ones because that would be a world of difference. But we need people who are tough, who are willing to say no to the federal government. And even in federal office, I mean, we watch we watch Congress quite a bit, and there only seem to be maybe a handful who realize that we need to say no to the feds. And so that's a very good point. We need to raise up or at least bring in lawmakers who can and will say no to the federal government, or else the federal government seems bent on destroying us.
Earlier in this episode.
Sorry, Gary, go ahead. No, okay. Go, Gary.
I was going to say, Paul, that earlier in this episode, you were asking the question where we are in the spectrum in terms of republic versus democracy. And my thought is that if you look at the law itself, we are still a republic because the Constitution is still the law of the land. We still have the Constitution. Yeah. We still have the Declaration of Independence, which is the birth document, so to speak, the birth certificate of our country.
Yeah.
So we have these things. So in that sense, we are still very much a republic. but we are a democracy in how we operate. And that seems like a contradiction.
It is, yeah.
But the reason we're a democracy in terms of how we operate is because we ignore, we circumvent, we thumb our nose at the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is this, the hope is because we still have the Constitution, we can still go back to the Constitution. We can still insist that our elected officials abide by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we wake up enough people where they are going to bring about that transformation. On the other hand, if we lose the Constitution and have nothing to go back to, well, then, of course, our ability to save our freedoms will become much less likely.
Yeah. Joe, you wanted to jump
in
there.
Gary said it all perfectly. I would say, first of all, amen. And second, I would say, you know, there's no tyranny without obedience to a tyrant, mm-hmm. first of all. And the first line of defense is our state government. Our state government is supposed to stand, as Madison said, as a barricade between potential federal tyranny and the people. So there is no tyranny without obedience to the tyrant. That's your obligation to get those state legislators and state governors who will, as Madison said, refuse to cooperate with the federal officers, right? That's right. The first thing. And second thing, as Gary is the shining example of this, and many people in the John Birch Society, you know, obedience to tyranny is disobedience to God. We've got to realize that there are two great commandments. One, you know, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and strength. And number two, love thy neighbor as thyself. If we're allowing government to steal the life, liberty, and property of our neighbor, we're violating that second great commandment.
Well said. Well said. I'm going to finish up with this, that being the Joe, you seem to be the perfect spokesperson here for the John Birch Society, but I will emphasize again, if you go to the John Birch Society, there's all sorts of information. We have information on our action projects. Correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but what we try to do there with those action projects is we don't just attack the symptoms. We go to the root. And for decades, we've been going at the United Nations. We've been trying to make sure that we keep our police local and independent, which gets to be a whole another topic that would fit into this. We have all sorts of information. We have that booklet that we just talked about, Republics and Democracies, that tie into this. You know, there you go. And we have the Declaration of Independence. Absolutely.
And the Constitution.
And the Constitution. Absolutely. I have
Constitution for the United States.
Right.
Right. Exactly. We have all that. And so going back, I mean, as far as this whole idea is that we need to teach people, we need people to realize that abolishing the Electoral College is not the answer, why Republicanism is the answer. So share this episode, share the booklets out there, pass them, download the PDF. And get everyone. Let's raise up a generations of people who hate democracy, down with democracy, and want to restore this great republic. Because really, there has never been anything like it in the history of Earth. There really hasn't. I mean, my parents risked their lives. My father risked his life to come to this country. He did 2 prison terms in communist prison to come to America, because everyone, that was the word in behind the Iron Curtain, get out of here, and the best place to be is America. And you know, and when he got here, this is not made up, this is not hyperbole, and I know it seems like a cliche or a movie, but we landed in New York and he saw the Statue of Liberty and he literally knelt down and he cried. Nothing like this has ever happened in the world up into the United States, and we are very close to losing, and we need to wake up. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Joe. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of New American Daily. Join us again on Monday, and remember to go to newamerican.com for more Truth Behind the News.